supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A Pennsylvania judge heard from three environmental groups today. They're seeking to temporarily block the start of construction on the Mariner East pipeline. This despite the project having received its final permits from state officials just 3 days ago. Joining me is WHYY's John Hurdle, who attended the proceedings in Harrisburg today. John, this is potentially the latest in a legacy of attempts to halt or slow down the construction of this pipeline. First, give us some background on the project and where we stand today.
Yes. Hi, Dave. Well, the $2.5 billion line would carry natural gas liquids from the Marcellus Shale of southwest Pennsylvania to an export terminal at Marcus Hook near Philadelphia.
And then on to Scotland.
Indeed.
What is the nature of the complaints that were lodged today?
Well, the three environmental groups filed an appeal saying that the project would cause what they call irreparable harm by cutting down trees and threatening public and private water wells with contamination. They're also saying that across the 350-mile length of the line, approximately 1,500 acres would be deforested, and there would be a total of about 3,000 acres of earth disturbance.
Though I imagine this is not the first time that environmental groups have coalesced to make a similar appeal.
Indeed, it's not. There's been a great deal of concern about this line. It's been going on for since 2013, when Sunoco Logistics first filed its permit applications. And one of the major concerns here is eminent domain. Some landowners across the state are fighting company's efforts to take land by eminent domain, and other residents in densely populated areas, especially near Philadelphia, are questioning the company's assurances that the line would be safe.
That the judge did not release a finding today, can anything be interpreted from that, and are we likely to learn before the weekend where it stands?
I don't know that anything can be interpreted one way or another at the moment, but I'm told that the judge is expected to rule on the environmental group's appeal tomorrow.
And back to those homeowners who are fighting based on eminent domain, is that being heard also in this court, or is that on a different track?
Those eminent domain court battles are being carried out in different counties across the state.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
WHYY's John Hurdle. In other news, restaurants and other businesses closed in cities across the country today protesting President Donald Trump and his promise to crack down on illegal immigration. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports that in the Philadelphia region, the impact of the so-called day without immigrants was small but symbolic.
Around noon, a steady stream of customers began flowing into Oyster House, a high-end seafood restaurant and raw bar in Center City. A sign on the window informed them the menu would be a bit limited today. Manager Andrea Flegel says that's because about 20 prep cooks, bussers, food runners, and hosts stayed home from work.
Luckily, we're in Oyster House, and we can always serve raw and chilled things. But yeah, a lot of the hot prepared foods, we just can't offer today.
Organizers say this was the very point of the Day Without Immigrants, to show how critical they are to the country's economy and way of life. So they encouraged immigrants, both documented and undocumented, to stay home from work and school. Most businesses remained open, but many closed their doors for the day. And in Montgomery County, Norristown School Superintendent says nearly a quarter of the district's students were not in class. That's about four times the average. A small group also participated in a rally near Philadelphia City Hall. 14-year-old Maria Santos Cerrone says she didn't want to just take the day off from school. She wanted to protest on behalf of her mom, an undocumented immigrant from Mexico.
It's not right for someone to just discriminate someone for their race and just call them rapists or say that we're stealing their jobs.
Santos Cerrone says while turnout for the protest was small, the impact was significant.
there wasn't a lot of people today, but there was enough for our voices to be heard.
And as many office buildings close up for the day, at least one King of Prussia-based cleaning company is warning it may be short-staffed tonight. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
Collingswood, New Jersey is fed up with abandoned houses, and it's doing something about it. The South Jersey town is using a decade-old state law to take control of abandoned homes, fix them up, and put them back on the market, as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
I'm standing in a bungalow on Harvard Avenue. It's cold.
Watch his backswing, please.
And Collingswood Mayor Jim Maley is about to plunge a sledgehammer into the dining room wall. This is the first house to be rehabbed as part of the town's new program for flipping abandoned homes. Collingswood is using a New Jersey law that lets towns seek control of neglected houses through the courts, then fix them up. Maley says it's a way to prevent neighborhood blight from spreading.
This is how it starts. It starts with one house going south, and then it has a little ripple effects as the drag on that begins to affect the property values of the other properties. So by doing that, you revive and give this neighborhood a chance to keep going.
Mary Heckman lives across the street.
It's a terrible eyesore. And of course, our houses are devalued.
Heckman says the bungalow has been abandoned for 8 years. She says sometimes property managers stop by and throw bleach on the wall to kill mold, but that's about it.
Most of the people here have worked very hard, you know, to keep their homes nice and livable and the street nice. And then when you have to look at that day in and day out, it's really a shame.
Yeah. Volunteers with the St. Joseph Carpenter Society are doing the repairs. Pilar Hogan-Klosky is the director.
The kitchen, the bathrooms need to be brought back up. It needs an entire new heating and air conditioning system. We'll be repairing the walls, new flooring. I think you can see through a hole in the bathroom down into the basement. We got to repair some of that stuff.
Collingswood is spending $150,000 to rehab the house, which it expects to recoup in the sale. The town has about 40 other abandoned properties on its list, but Mayor Jim Maley says the problem is much bigger than that.
This issue is in every town in New Jersey for different reasons, but everybody has this issue. And this is our chance to, you know, start reversing the tide.
From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
It was just 7 weeks ago that it was implemented, and now Philadelphia's soda tax is again being challenged in City Hall. This as soda industry workers lobby to have the tariff rolled back. Details from WHYY's Tom McDonald.
The cut in consumption is shocking, says John Carpinetta, who works as a salesman for Coca-Cola and lives in Holmesburg.
We're down in total sales volume anywhere from 30% to 50%. And it's going to get worse because there's two big retailers that have absorbed the price. Those retailers have opted to honor their advertising for the first quarter.
Carpinetta says it's meant big changes in his lifestyle and his family's future.
My son graduates high school in a couple months, and I had to go to him and say, son, your first choice of Drexel University is no longer an option.
Jerry Doherty is sales manager at Pepsi Cola in Philadelphia. He says complaints are continuous and his commissioned salesmen are suffering because of the drop in sales.
One of our employees this week is going home with a paycheck of $200. He's not some kid. He's a 15-year employee. He's got kids in college and he's taking $200 home to wife and family.
Councilman Bill Greenlee says he's sympathetic, but he and other council members had a tough choice to make.
You have to see both ways, certainly to the businesses, certainly to the people who work in the businesses, but also to the people, the parents who are now getting pre-K that they did not get before, and also to the communities that will be getting their rec centers and playgrounds fixed.
Councilman Curtis Jones says he's gotten an earful from drivers and others affected by the soda tax, but doesn't expect a repeal.
I'm always open, but the likelihood of us doing another vote is less likely.
And Greenlee says he doesn't remember any tax being eliminated. Representatives of the soda industry suggest replacing the tax with a levy on shopping bags. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The libraries at Penn State University hold some 5 million volumes, and today they added 14 more so-called human books that volunteered to loan their experiences as part of the university's first human library. Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff checked out the books on offer.
Brian Davis is well known around campus, and not just because the Penn State junior is always wearing a suit. He's triple majoring and double minoring, is actively involved in organizations across campus, and has the ear of the university's president. But that's not where his story begins.
So my story is about me growing up in West Philadelphia and from me joining a gang and to how that was for me every single day, whether that was getting shot at, fearing for my life, or fighting just because that was like the mental capacity I had at the time.
Davis joined a gang in Philadelphia when he was 15. He dealt drugs, saw friends get shot, and believed that his life could end in only two places, jail or death. But he kept his grades up and eventually joined a football team, where he found mentorship and an outlet. When Davis was accepted to Penn State, he tried to separate his old life from his new life.
I felt like the story would hinder me in some ways in the future, but at the same time, I was like, you know, if I can survive all of that, why would I be scared to tell my story?
Davis shared his experiences publicly for the first time as part of Penn State's Human Library. Davis volunteered to be a book that small groups could borrow for 45 minutes at a time. Penn State's Human Library featured speakers, I mean books, who'd experienced fat shaming, having a parent suffer from mental illness, coming to this country as an immigrant, and growing up on an Indian reservation, among others. The Human Library aimed to have a diversity of experiences not prominently represented on campus, says Megan Gilpin, outreach coordinator at Penn State Libraries.
There are barriers out there that other people have experienced that I have not experienced. So we want people to recognize those, you know, and hear about those experiences so that they can learn about the people around them and the challenges that they face.
Gilpin first learned about Human Libraries at a conference last year, but the idea has been around since 2000, when the first one was held in Copenhagen. Since then, it has spread to 60 countries, popping up in community centers, classrooms, and college campuses.
Sometimes, you know, we have questions about people that are different than us, and, you know, it's nice to be able to actually ask those questions and in a safe and supportive environment. We're hoping that people can provide the answers and everybody will learn something new.
Librarian Kelly Kasarian asked Davis about leaving West Philadelphia behind for Penn State.
Do you ever encounter, if you go back, people who are angry with you or resentful?
I actually think when I go back home that I'm actually protected by my community and that they've seen all the things that I'm doing, so they don't want anything to happen to me at this point.
Penn State is hoping to make the Human Library an annual event. Many of this year's first editions said they enjoyed sharing their time as books, but are looking forward to borrowing others' experiences in the future. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. Jews who came to the United States from Central Europe over a century ago maintained their values, identity, and traditions in part through klezmer music. Hank Osnetsky comes from a family of klezmerim in the Philadelphia area who performed at weddings and funerals. He went on to found the Klezmer Conservatory Band, and he teaches at the New England Conservatory in Boston. He joins me to discuss his book entitled Klezmer, Music and Community in 20th Century Jewish Philadelphia. Hankus, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Great to be here, Dave.
Let's take up the word. Klezmer, I presume, is a Yiddish word?
It's a Yiddish word. It comes from two Hebrew words, klei zemer, and that becomes klezmer. And then if there's more than one, they're klezmorim.
And what would the rough translation be?
Professional Jewish folk instrumentalists. They're guys who played the music for parties, the Jewish equivalent of zydeco or Cajun music or, you know, Irish session music.
Now, why Philadelphia? Why specifically? I would imagine larger immigrant Jewish populations in, say, New York or Chicago.
Well, actually, Philadelphia had and still has a really strong ethnic heritage. And every community in Philadelphia has maintained its ethnic heritage in ways that have not tended to happen as much in other cities. So the Jewish community in Philadelphia was very, very tied to Europe, very tied to the old ways, very tied to things that were kind of barriers against assimilation. I mean, look, on New Year's, I still live stream the Mummers Parade from up here in Boston. So I think Philadelphia is pretty unique.
Hankus, before we get much further, why don't we hear an example of klezmer music? What would you suggest?
Well, you know, we're going to be playing with an older Philadelphia band leader named Bobby Block on Sunday at Beth Shalom on the 19th. So let's hear Bobby. He's going to play a song that kind of really has that old-time Hasidic spirit. It's called a Yiddish Niggun, an old Jewish melody.
Appreciation for and performance of klezmer music did wane before what is now widely regarded as a revival or resurgence, and you were certainly a part of that. Explain.
Well, I was very much, and it did wane, and that really had to do with, honestly, the fact that in the mainstream Jewish community, there no longer was an interest, really, in that ethnicity. Certainly in Jewish education, it was frowned upon. It was really something that people wanted to shy away from. Assimilation, of course, was one thing, but really after the Holocaust, there was this idea Eastern Europe was gone, and remembering it was not in the agenda, and Israel was the focus for anything that was contemporary and modern. Therefore, this music did wane and got replaced at celebrations, but it held on in Philadelphia longer than almost anywhere else. So it was still, when I started rediscovering it, there were still people around who knew all about it. And in fact, there are to this very day. I'm about to play a concert in Philadelphia with a bunch of them.
Take us back to Israel once again in 2017. Is there a simpatico for klezmer that wasn't there, say, 50 years ago, 60 years ago?
Absolutely. There's definitely a young movement. Again, it's kind of an anti-establishment movement, interestingly enough. It's something that is kind of below the surface. Yiddish is huge in Israel, as is klezmer music and a grassroots revival among younger people.
Back in the day, one couldn't easily make a living performing klezmer. Musicians would be affiliated with other bands or orchestras or have other jobs. In 2017, can one make a living playing klezmer music?
I think there are probably some people who make their living playing this music. But honestly, the best place to do that is Europe at the moment. Poland, Germany, places where there are these clubs that actually want to, in some way, really remember Jewish Eastern Europe. And these bands work full-time, and they can do that. I mean, I can remember a band coming to me in Krakow, Poland, at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the band leader came over. They were playing for us after a festival and said they had to leave. And I said, oh, I understand that. Of course, you guys have... No, you don't understand. We have another gig across town. 3 o'clock in the morning. So in Europe, I think there's a recognition that Jewish culture, this Eastern European Jewish music and Jewish culture... is something that really needs to be preserved. It's kind of like their own soul is bound up with it. And that might have something to do with the Holocaust. But here, you know, I think most of the people who play this play all kinds of music, and I think that's been true for a long time.
Hankus, tell us about your upcoming performance here in Philadelphia on Sunday.
Well, we're going to be playing at Temple Beth Shalom, and that is... a concert that is open to everybody, and we hope people will come out to dance, and also I'll have the book to sign at that concert, too.
Hankus, take us out with a selection. What do you have in mind?
I think we should hear Candles Orchestra from the 1920s playing By a Glezel Mashki with a glass of whiskey.
Thank you for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
It's been a pleasure.
Hankus Netzke, author of the book entitled Klezmer, Music and Community in 20th Century Jewish Philadelphia. And you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.